Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, as the Kamala Harris-Tim Walz presidential campaign is hoping to make history in Florida, we'll talk with historian and political expert James C. Clark about influential women in Florida politics.
Florida was a purple state, as they say. Could go either way.
We'll discuss Tamuquin healing practices.
Sorcerers receive special interest from both the Spanish and French.
And we'll talk about the Spanish Seminole. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. There are currently more registered Republicans in Florida than Democrats, but many people in Florida are excited about the Kamala Harris-Tim Walz presidential campaign. Harris joins a group of women who have run for president of the United States. Historian, author, and political expert James C. Clark explains that Victoria Woodhull is recognized as the first woman to run for president in 1872.
She was a candidate for something called the Equal Rights Party, which fielded candidates for about 20 years. She was run out of town during the campaign for advocating free love, which did not go well in 1872. She said in a speech that she reserved the right to have sex with anyone, anytime. And if she had any hope at all of getting any votes, that kind of killed it.
The most successful female presidential candidate from the Equal Rights Party was Belva Ann Lockwood, who claimed more than 4,000 votes in six states in 1888. At the 1920 Democratic National Convention, two women, Laura Clay and Cora Wilson Stewart, received one vote each from delegates, becoming the first women to do so from a major political party. Jim Clark.
The Democrats were badly divided in 1920, and I think you and I got votes that year, Ben. Everybody seemed to get votes that year.
Kamala Harris was the first successful female vice presidential candidate, but was not the first to run for VP. That was Charlotte Bass in 1952 for the Progressive Party. In 1964, Margaret Chase Smith, a Republican woman senator from Maine, was considered as a presidential candidate.
Yeah, she got about 24 votes at the convention, mostly a kind of favorite daughter support at the 1964 convention, which nominated Barry Goldwater. So it was more of a, hey, we really like you kind of a thing. And she withdrew after the first ballot.
Kamala Harris is not the first Black female presidential candidate. That distinction goes to Charlene Mitchell, who received more than 1,000 votes in four states for the Communist Party in 1966. More familiar is Shirley Chisholm. Jim Clark.
Shirley Chisholm in 1972 is the first African-American woman to seek a major party nomination, running as a Democrat, and the first really to launch a serious campaign with volunteers and rallies and staff members, not just saying I'm a candidate. And she got 152 delegate votes. So she won some places and picked up some support and served in Congress from New York for a number of years after that.
In 1984, Geraldine Ferraro was the first woman nominated for vice president by a major political party.
Yeah, in 1984, you'll remember Ronald Reagan was running for re-election. He was far ahead in the polls. And Walter Mondale was desperate to do anything to gain some attention, gain some traction. So he nominated Geraldine Ferrara, which got a lot of publicity. But in the end, he only carried one state, so it didn't seem to help him much.
In 2008, Sarah Palin was the Republican vice presidential nominee. Jim Clark.
That shows kind of the dangers of nominating people. It's generally agreed that Sarah Palin was not ready for prime time and hurt the McCain ticket and may have cost him the election. She was the governor of Alaska, but when she was nominated, few people knew much about her. They had not done their homework.
Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton won the popular vote for president in 2016, but not the presidency.
Yes, she has come close. Remember, in 2008, she ran for the nomination and Barack Obama beat her. She came back 8 years later and, again, as you point out, won the popular vote, but ran a pretty bad campaign. She did not campaign, for example, in Wisconsin and a couple other of the swing states, and she lost by the narrowest of margins.
As Jim Clark explains, Florida has had many successful female politicians, including Ruth Bryant Owen.
First of all, she was the daughter of William Jennings Bryan, the three-time Democratic presidential nominee. Well-known political figure around 1900. And her father moved to Coral Gables and worked for the Merricks, helping them sell land in Coral Gables, and he made a fortune. And she ran for Congress. And Ben, you know this well, how small Florida was back then. The district that she represented stretched from Jacksonville to Miami and included Orlando. So about half the state was represented by Ruth Bryant Owen. Plus, she was one of the very first women in Congress. There only been about 8 or 9 women elected before her. And so Florida kind of blazed the path in sending one of the first women to Congress. Her undoing was related to her father. Like her father, she was a dry. She was for prohibition. And in 1932, she ran against a wet who favored the repeal of prohibition and was easily defeated by a 2-to-1 margin. So, but she did go on to become ambassador to Denmark in the Roosevelt administration and was the first woman to hold ambassadorial rank.
In the 1980s, Paula Hawkins became the only woman from Florida elected to the United States Senate.
Paula Hawkins from Utah, like so many of our politicians, moved to Florida her husband had a business in Winter Park. And she got interested in politics as a volunteer back when the Republican Party was almost non-existent in Florida, and worked very hard and then ran for the Public Service Commission, became widely known as a consumer activist, ran for Senate once, ran for lieutenant governor once with Jack Eckert, lost both of those, and then finally in 1980, in the Republican sweep with Ronald Reagan, was elected to the Senate and only served one term, several embarrassing incidents misspoken several times. And she was defeated by Bob Graham in 1986 after just one term.
Another notable female politician from Florida is Val Demings from Orlando.
The former police chief turned congresswoman who lost a bid for the United States Senate a couple of years ago by a wide margin, but has now been named to the Post Office Regulatory Committee. So she'll be deciding when we get our mail, Ben.
Kamala Harris is trying to make history in Florida and the nation as a serious presidential candidate. She's even inspired a show of support in the Villages, a community known as a conservative stronghold. I asked Jim Clark if the Harris-Walz ticket has a chance of winning in Florida.
Florida was a purple state, as they say. Could go either way. And remember, just 6 years ago, Andrew Gillum lost the governorship by 30,000 votes and probably would have won had the Broward County ballots not been messed up, as you remember. And now the Republicans seem firmly in control. I think one of the things that helped the Republicans was that President Obama made overtures to Cuba to try to normalize relations with Cuba. And I think he thought that maybe a new younger generation of Cuban Americans would be ready for that, but they weren't. And so in the last presidential election, they turned out in droves for the Republican candidates and cost a couple of congressional seats in South Florida that had been held by the Democrats.
In addition to hoping for a Harris-Walz presidential win, Jim Clark says that Democrats in Florida also want Debbie Mercarsel Powell to retake an important Senate seat.
Rick Scott is running for re-election. The Democrats would love to defeat him. They have come close to defeating him in, what, three elections, but he always seems to eke out a victory.
We spoke with historian, author, and political expert James C. Clark about history-making female politicians in Florida, including presidential candidate Kamala Harris. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find out about the 2025 Caribbean Conference Cruise presented by the Florida Historical Society and the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities, May 2nd through 10th. Registration is now open for this exciting, educational, and engaging Caribbean Conference Cruise. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Everybody's doing the best that they can. On the medicine man. The medicine man.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Tomuqua once occupied over 19,000 square miles in South Georgia and North Florida with a population of around 200,000. The 1564 accounts of René Laudonnière and Jacques Lemoyne and the subsequent engravings by Theodore Debray are well known to most historians and the public, although the controversies surrounding the authenticity of the engravings are equally well known. Fewer people are likely aware of the 17th century work of Spanish Franciscan friar Francisco Pareja. His Tomuquan grammar, catechisms in the Tomuquan language, and confessional were based on his years of interaction with the Tomuquans near his San Juan del Puerto mission on Fort George Island near Jacksonville. He apparently expected his work to be useful introductions to the Tomuquans for new friars at the mission.
Professor Tamara Shearcliffe-Spike used these sources to understand Tomuquan healing practices in an article she published in the Florida Historical Quarterly in the fall of 2015. As she notes, both French and Spanish observers found Tomuquan healing practices to be anti-doctrinal. Pareja's confessional was, quote, intended to enumerate and describe what to the Franciscans were sinful native practices in order to eradicate them among their indigenous charges, end quote. The period under discussion in this article, 1564 to 1613, witnessed profound changes for Florida Indians, including prolonged contact with Europeans, disease, missionization, shifting trade patterns, dietary changes, and slave raids. Quote, Native peoples' conceptions of identity, gender, culture, religion, and cosmology were challenged, if not outright attacked, end quote. Spike acknowledges that the limited sources do not allow for deep understanding of this change over time. Instead, she notes, the 50-year period provides a snapshot of the first generation after missionization.
Connie, Timucuans, like other indigenous people, suffered an enormous demographic collapse with the introduction of old world diseases like measles, smallpox, mumps, and influenza.
Spike argues that the mission environment exacerbated the problem and helped spread disease. She writes, quote, prohibitions against nudity, less frequent bathing, and confinement in and near missions made Native people more vulnerable to the louse-borne disease of typhus, end quote. In addition, declining health among Timucuans can be attributed to dietary changes, lack of food, increased population density, and forced labor systems. For historians, the records are vague, failing to explicitly identify disease outbreaks, quote, almost always referring to them as plagues, end quote. Archaeological evidence is also less enlightening than one might expect. Spike concludes that Timucuans likely suffered from the newly introduced European diseases, as well as those endemic to North America, including tuberculosis and treponema, a bacteria linked to syphilis.
The cosmologies, the understanding of the origins of the universe, differed significantly between Europeans and indigenous people. The Timucuan cosmology can be seen in their approach to disease. For Pareja, some rites and rituals practiced by the Timucuan healers were acceptable, but others were not, right?
Pareja described Timucuan cosmology in terms of purity sacred, pollution, and impure. The purity sacred symbols and objects included fire, blood, corn, tobacco, and black drink, a caffeinated beverage known as yaupon tea. These symbols used by higher levels of healers were used to create a temporary personal state of purity. Purity was not the nominal state of being. Pollution was the state that endangered humans and included disease, childbirth, flow of blood, and dead bodies. As Spike explained, quote, the concepts of purity and pollution were dyads, interrelated to the sacred. Although individuals could and did achieve a state of ritual purity and could become polluted, it endangered normal individuals, end quote. The third state, impurity, was associated with everyday life, the normative state. Pareja also provided general descriptions of the various types of healers, doctors, herbalists, sorcerers, and midwives. Each of the categories contain overlapping powers. The confessional poses the same questions to all categories, healing with herbs and prayers, and lighting separate fires as a curing rite. Both sorcerers and herbalists were questioned about bewitchment. Herbalists and midwives were asked about childbirth, but only women were questioned about abortion and miscarriage. Sorcerers received special interest from both the Spanish and French. They were associated with magic rites in addition to the other healing rituals. La Donniere also identifies a group he labels as priests who were diviners, advisors, conductors of sacrificial rites, and surgeons. Disease could be controlled magically through the alteration of the environment. Beyond its symbolic value, fire served as a conveyor of medication, uniting the forces of herbal and magical healing when seeds or plants were thrown into the fire and the smoke was inhaled by the diseased. Pareja listed a number of healing practices that he determined were acceptable under church doctrine. Timucuans were basically herbalists, and their medicines were adopted by Europeans. The friar was more concerned about the use of herbs for birth control and to induce abortions. Timucuans and Europeans both utilized bloodletting in their healing. Isolation of the polluted and the dietary descriptions were also described. Moyne identified a fourth group involved in Timucuan healing practices, third gender persons who functioned in a role more like that of nurse, cooking, bathing, and performing basic tasks for the infirm. They also prepared the bodies of the dead and transported them to the burial site. As Spike explained, quote, third persons like shamans, herbalists, and midwives must have been among the select group that were able to successfully negotiate the spiritually dangerous atmosphere, which combined the pollution of illness, the danger of fertility and childbirth, and the purifying agent of the fires, a hypercharged environment of the sacred, both pure and polluted, end quote. Relying on the healing practices of the shaman, the herbalist, the midwife, and the third gender persons, Spike concludes that, quote, in part, through the continuation of these pre-Columbian healing practices, the Timucuans were able to retain some semblance of a cosmological order on states defined by purity, pollution, and impurity, end quote.
Fascinating information. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. David Rajahidi Webb is author of the award-winning book, The Spanish Seminole. Sebastian Garcia spoke with the author about his research, which adds to our understanding of Florida's indigenous people.
Chwet Nagayaskiskana, David Giothet, Uchat Rajahidi, Oksanahe Wawe, Skarure Diwagosnutne.
That was David Rajahidi Webb, and you just heard him say, quote, my name is David, my real name is Rajahidi, and I'm a member of the Tuscarora Nation, end quote. I spoke with David Rajahidi Webb about his award-winning book, The Spanish Seminole, The Untold History of the Spanish Indians as Shared by a Descendant. Unfamiliar to most audiences, the Spanish Seminoles are remarkably diverse and active people who played a crucial role throughout Florida's history, especially in the Southwest region.
They were traditionally, they've been called the Spanish Indians, and that's because they were a group of amalgamated people from the Creek Nation or Muscogee-speaking people and Miccosukee-speaking people or Ilopongi, Yarkadishi people who moved down the coast but blended with the original Calusa people in the region. And so they were part of a continuation of 6,000 years of Calusa culture that included fishing in the bays and backwaters. It was a very prolific industry. Tons and tons of fish were shipped largely down to Cuba, to Regla, which was the port of call for these fisheries.
The compound term Spanish Seminole indicates a blend of Spanish and indigenous peoples and culture. However, such a cultural merger, or creolization, was not entirely absolute, partly because of their forced migration down the Florida coast by American settlers during the 19th century.
What you find is a little bit of an ethnogenesis taking place, but I wouldn't call it a full creolization of the people. And the reason for that is a lot of the Spanish who have been called the Spanish Indians of Southwest Florida originated in the Panhandle. And so following their baptism records, where my own family is included, I was able to translate all of them and identify statistically where individuals came from, where their parents came from, who was Hispanic Latino, who was indigenous. And I was able to find that 100% of the mothers were indigenous from towns that were located along the Apalachicola River and what the Spanish called Apalache, or the Apalache province around Tallahassee, present-day Tallahassee. And they moved down the coast as Americans came in. They were burning down their towns and raiding. Andrew Jackson started that trend. And so they were displaced. As they go further down the coast, we can identify families that started to have children born on places like Sanibel Island. And one record I share is of my own family that was the first documented birth, probably in southern Florida, but specifically on Sanibel.
The baptism records David Rajahidi consulted with were crucial, as previous scholarship had either overlooked or dismissed such sources. Indeed, David Rajahidi's use of these sources underscores how his work filled a glaring research gap.
They're not widely known. They haven't really been published on very much. And I think my work is the first that really did a statistical deep dive. And I take all of the stats of fathers, mothers, demographics. There were some fathers who were Maya people who had revolted against Spain's colonization of the Yucatan and were brought as servants or slaves to Cuba. And they were working in the ranchos, and a few of them married these Seminole women. I think it's really the first time that anybody's taken a look at it, and primarily as a descendant of the families that are documented here. There aren't a whole lot of people who can trace their ancestry back to this population. And I think also I only identify as a descendant of these communities. I'm an enrolled member of my tribe, which is very different, but I do offer an indigenous take on things. And that perspective, I think, makes it unique when interpreting these baptism records.
As David Rahahadi mentioned, critically interpreting sources is as essential as discovering previously obscured or ignored records. His personal connection to this work and his roots in the Tuscarora Nation more broadly positions David Rahahadi as a unique authority on the subject, and, more importantly, how to study the subject.
Indigenous methodologies employ indigenous culture and traditions, so we place a lot of importance on oral histories and stories that are passed down. We put a lot of faith in our elders to carry those stories. And we have specific practices when it comes to passing those things down that help to maintain their integrity. So indigenous methodologies really opens the door to more traditional academic study to allow other voices, in this case, indigenous voices, to be included.
Central to indigenous methodologies is decolonizing research.
Anthropology was really founded on settler colonialism, and it started out as a means to study cultures that colonizers saw as being inferior to Western European culture. So it is inherently biased. And when we talk about decolonizing that research, we're trying to take that bias out so that we can include indigenous perspectives. And when you approach it from that direction, your research is going to be a lot fuller, more complete, and less biased.
Indigenous methodologies also enable researchers like David Rahahadi to deconstruct certain myths about indigenous groups, notably that the Seminoles and other native tribes of Florida virtually disappeared or were entirely eradicated.
I call this the myth of the colonizer, and it makes it a lot more ethically digestible for people who are enjoying the legacies of settler colonialism, including genocide and ethnic cleansing that took place here in Florida. The removal of Seminole people was nothing less than ethnic cleansing. And so it's easier for people to say the original inhabitants of Florida are all gone. If you put yourself in an indigenous methodologies approach, you'll find that it's really not relevant to say that because the present day Miccosukee people especially lived within what we now call Florida, and also the Seminole who are of Creek speaking descent did as well.
To learn more about the Spanish Seminole and Florida's indigenous peoples more broadly, consider purchasing a copy of David Rahahadi's award-winning book, The Spanish Seminole, available online at myfloridahistory.org and other vendors. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.